Well, good morning, everybody. And I want to say hi to everybody in San Jose and San Mateo and Mountain View and the cafe and folks joining us from all over the world online. I'm so glad that you're here. Whatever faith tradition that you might be from, if you're visiting, you should know this is kind of an unusual weekend. Usually at this point, somebody stands up and just talks on and on and on. But we're doing kind of a different deal today. And we have invited some folks to be with us. You all know, we look at our world, we're super concerned, and there's a lot of tension. And we read stories and see pictures that involve violence and brokenness in our world around topics like faith and spirituality and how do people come to know God. And we're all real concerned about this, but as a church, we don't want to just be on the I'm alarmed about this side. We want to be on the solution side. We actually want to be working for a better day. And so we have invited folks from different faith traditions to be with us for this weekend. And we do that not in spite of our commitment to following Jesus, but precisely because of it. Because what Jesus said was at the heart of what human beings need to do is love God with all of our heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love our neighbor as ourselves. And this weekend, we get to hear from our neighbors. And that's a great gift to us. We all had dinner last night, and just to be sitting around a table and talking with people for whom the question of God really matters was such a great gift. So as best we can, we'd like to kind of recreate that, just have you feel like you're sitting around the table with us. Because there is so much tension around faith and religion in our world, sometimes folks will try to diffuse that by saying, well, really all religions teach the same thing. And so we want to say we don't believe that as a church. And we actually did a panel deal about a year and a half ago that looked precisely at that question. And the reality is that all the folks that will be on this platform may have quite different convictions from one another around God or life or faith or salvation or so on. And we think that the best way to honor that is not pretend like those differences don't exist, but to learn and to understand and to respect. And at the same time, we all have a lot of common concerns with each other. We stand on common ground. We care about our children. We care about our cities. We care about peace. We care about our world. And so we're going to have a conversation about how can we live together in our world in a way that leads towards peace and well-being and not the other direction. And I want you now to meet the folks that will be on this panel. So take a look at the screens. They're going to come on up.
Rita Sharma is the Associate Professor of Dharma Studies and Director of the Hindu Studies Initiative at Berkeley's Graduate Theological Union. John Figdor is the Humanist Chaplain at Stanford University and speaker on humanist topics across the U.S. and is frequently featured in prominent media outlets. Jihad Turk is the founding president of Islamic Graduate School, Bayan Claremont, and is a nationally recognized speaker representative and a civic leader for the Muslim faith in America. Sean Landris is a researcher, essayist, social entrepreneur, and co-founder of Jumpstart, a philanthropic research and design lab focused on Jewish and other faith-based social innovation. Richard Mao is a leading voice of thoughtful Christian faith and a professor of faith and public life at Fuller Theological Seminary, where he served as president for 20 years.
So let me say a couple words about the ground rules here. First of all, this is not a debate. We're not going to keep score. We're not going to take a vote at the end to see who won. This is a chance for us to practice a really important virtue that's talked about in the Bible and in other places, and that is hospitality. And these are our guests. If you think about it, it takes a fair amount of courage for the folks on this panel to come here and be in this place and talk with you about their faith and their traditions. And one of them was asking before we did this panel last time, if I come to your church, what should I expect? And I said, well, you should expect kindness and warmth and grace and compassion and love. Because that describes almost everybody here. And we want it to be all of us. And this is kind of our opportunity to extend hospitality to folks who are willing to take this step and to be with us. So could you let them know how grateful we are that they would be willing to be here? And we got a whole bunch of questions from all of you over the last several weeks. And again, we want this conversation to be one that is gracious and civil. So I'll read the first question. Why do you think your particular religious tradition is correct and everybody else on the platform is wrong? Rich, Mal?
Well, as Christians, we focus on who Jesus Christ is, the one whom God sent to go to the cross for us. He raised him from the dead. And that really is a unique emphasis of the Christian faith, of the Christian gospel. And for us, that's non-negotiable. But the Jesus who did all of that and who did for us what we could never do for ourselves by saving us also calls us to be the kind of people who are willing not just to love our neighbors, but also to learn from our neighbors. It's one thing for us to say Jesus is the truth, but it's another thing to acknowledge that as the creator of all things, that there's a lot of truth out there for us to discover. And I just love these conversations in which I always come away learning some things about where we were wrong, learning some things about how we have sinned against people with whom we disagree, but just also learning some very marvelous things about the spiritual journeys that
when we were talking about this event, you reminded me of the story of Jonah. You want to say a word about that, about when he was on the ship and the sailors spoke to him?
Well, you know, here's Jonah on their ship and the storm comes up and there's a discussion between the pagan sailors and Jonah. Now, if that's all you knew, you had the prophet of God on a ship, the ship's in trouble, and the pagan soldiers are talking to the prophet of God, who would you put your money on? We'd obviously put it on the prophet of God. But the fact is, he was running away. And in that case, the pagan sailors were wrong, were the right ones. And this is a wonderful example where people outside of the faith tradition are preaching a message of truth to the church, to the prophet of God. And I think one of the things we want to do today is hear the sermons that are being preached to us, because we have a lot to learn, and often we really mess things up.
Great story. And everybody doesn't have to respond to this question, but if anybody else wants to, why do you feel like your tradition is correct and the others are wrong, or do you not feel that that's the way things are? Anybody who wants to respond?
I'd like to respond to that. I think that one of the strengths of Hinduism, or as Hindus call it, Hindu Dharma, is that it sees God as an infinite diamond. And like a diamond, it has infinite facets. And who is seeing God from every single facet? Our minds are not infinite, they're finite. Our bodies are finite. Our thoughts are conditioned. We can only see God or the infinite through a particular facet, the facet that we're conditioned to see the divine through. And therefore, the Hindu world has a great deal of difficulty understanding people of other faiths who say, there is no other way, there is no other facet, because Hindus don't understand the limiting of the limitless.
Thank you. Another question, and this will be for everybody here. There was a book that came out a while ago asking the question, was Abraham Lincoln a Christian? And one of the prior questions you have to get to is, how do you decide whether you think somebody was a Christian or not? What makes somebody a Christian? So for each one of your traditions, this would just be an opportunity for us to kind of lean in and learn. How do you decide if somebody else is Jewish or Hindu or so on? Sean, you want to start?
Sure. I guess it depends on whether you think arguing is a full contact sport. If you do, then you're Jewish. But
I was going to say, I can't wait to tell my wife, but I don't know if I should say that or not.
She's too. Yeah.
Well, you did tell me you played Tevye and Fiddler on the Roof, so you know. I think that at one level, to be Jewish is to be recognized by someone else who is Jewish as Jewish. I can imagine whatever I want, but the conversation that I'm in, the terms of the way I relate with other people who think of themselves as Jewish, what makes us Jewish is what we find in common that we do together as Jews. And I think that has its root in a basic, it's a theological premise, it's also a premise of social solidarity. In every generation, each one of us as Jews is commanded to see ourselves as if God brought us out of Egypt. Out of the house of bondage. And so in every generation, every year at Passover, I'm commanded to tell my children that we do this because of what God did for me in bringing me out of Egypt to stand at Sinai. The rest really is commentary. That notion of throwing my lot in with the Jewish people, of seeing myself as having been taken out of slavery to freedom, to covenant, is really what is the beginning of a conversation, and then the rest is what unfolds beyond.
You know, as you can imagine, when you just think about Christianity and how diverse it can be and how varied the Christian community is, to try to be a representative of a religion is really, really hard. But Sean, that said, would there be differences within the Jewish community around whether or not that identification Jewish would belong to somebody, how important their religious convictions would be for it? Or would that be something where there'd be a pretty shared understanding?
It's really, there would be disagreements, but it's hard to align those disagreements. In other words, there would be, I identify more with the, theologically, I would say, I identify with more progressive wings of the Jewish tradition, but the most ultra-Orthodox of Jewish leaders would recognize me as a Jew because I'm the child of a Jewish mother. And then he'd say I'm doing it wrong. But where we get into trouble is, and we actually haven't talked about this before in last year or this year, is in the heart of the convert. There are a lot of debates right now in Israel, particularly on the ultra-Orthodox side, with kind of looking back at conversions and saying, oh no, that person wasn't doing it right, therefore they must never have been Jewish in the first place. And again, even on the more Orthodox side, all the way out to the more progressive side, there are others of us who believe, no, once you're converted, that's it, you're done. And it goes back to the standing at Sinai, because the belief is that anyone who converts to Judaism, what must have happened is that their soul was at Sinai.
Wow.
And so what's happening is that they're reconnecting with that original covenant moment. And you can't take that away from someone, no matter, you know, what happens afterwards. So.
Well, let me skip over. We've not heard from Jihad yet. So let me go to you and then John next. And Jihad also was very graciously last night said, why don't you ask me to explain a little bit about my name to everybody. So would you do that now?
Well, I really wanted to give you a chance to back out from having invited Jihad to a church here in Menlo Park.
Too late.
So I'm an American kid from Arizona. My mom's Methodist Christian from Oklahoma. And my father's from Jerusalem, so I say my mom's from the Midwest and my dad's from the Mideast. And growing up in Phoenix, we didn't have a lot of diversity. You were either black, white, or Mexican, and with a name like Jihad, it was exotic enough, people just thought it was some kind of weird Mexican name, maybe Oaxacan or something, Jihad. But my friends called me Jay and on the soccer team and at school, and when my father got wind of that when I was maybe 7 or 8 years old, and the roster of the soccer team came out, said Jay Turk, J-A-Y Turk, he crossed it out and he wrote J-I-H-A-D, and he went to one of the soccer games and he passed it out to all the parents, and I was mortified. I was like very embarrassed. I was like, Dad, what are you doing? He said, no, your name has a good meaning. It means the struggle to do the right thing. And it might be strange or difficult for people to pronounce, but it's important. And from then on, I always took pride in my name as something to live up to. I haven't quite done so, but that's a whole nother story. With regards to the religious connotations of the meaning that I came to know as I went on to seminary and became an academic in the study of Islam and theology, I came to understand the fuller meaning. And yes, it means the struggle to one's utmost to do the right thing, to do the right thing within oneself, within society, as we saw in the video that you shared earlier of the good works that the church here is doing, the community. That's a form of jihad in society. But also, yes, if your homeland is under attack, to defend it. And that is a righteous thing to do in very constrained circumstances. Unfortunately, some Muslims around the world who have geopolitical ambitions and who are preying on the ignorance of many Muslims, because quite frankly, the Muslim world is, in many parts of the world, economically impoverished and illiterate. There's a high degree of illiteracy in general, and religious illiteracy about Islam in particular. They prey on that ignorance and invoke the name of God, which is a powerful idea to claim religion and God, to justify things that are barbaric and counter to the very teachings of Islam. And claim in the name of jihad acts of terrorism or some kind of militant or violent extremist movement. It's an affront to our faith, and it's something that we categorically denounce and reject. And so, what was the other question? I got distracted there with all this just talk of violence and extremism.
Wah. It was, how do you tell if somebody is a Muslim?
So if they are an expert in violent, no, I'm just kidding. to be a Muslim, it's actually surprising, and I was thinking about it this morning, Islam is somewhere theologically between Judaism and Christianity, mm-hmm. on the spectrum of theology, if you will. We're very monotheistic, like Jews are.
You're more monotheistic.
More monotheistic even than Jews, according to Sean. But we also believe in Jesus as Christ, born to the Virgin Mary, inspired by the Holy Spirit. And we are, as Muslims, and the word Muslim means the one who submits their will to God, or we try to, we are followers of Jesus. But we also follow the religion of Abraham, who preceded Islam, Judaism, and Christianity, whose religion was to worship God and God alone, and to be good to your fellow human being. And so when Muhammad came, and who was a descendant of Abraham, who was born almost six centuries after Jesus, he said, I'm not coming with a new faith, I'm coming with the faith of Abraham. And so there's a lot of misunderstanding sometimes about that, what it is that Muslims believe, but because sometimes we use the word Allah to refer to God, but that's just the Arabic name for God, mm-hmm. just as Dios is in Spanish. And so Jews and Christians who speak Arabic refer to God as Allah as well. But to be a Muslim is to believe in one God and to do your best to serve God through not only worshiping him, but serving your fellow human being and preparing for the day of accountability, mm-hmm. the day of judgment, in which we'll stand individually in judgment before God.
Thank you. So, John, tell us a little bit about both how you would recognize somebody, and then there are different terms that get used, humanist, secularist, atheist, agnostic. So walk us through a little bit about that language.
Sure. So first, thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here. I think that we'll start with the word atheist. I think people have heard this a lot. It's people like Richard Dawkins and Sam Harris have made it popular in the news. But all atheism means is not having a belief in God or gods. The next term that you brought up was agnostic, and agnosticism doesn't refer to whether you believe or not. It refers to your degree of strength in your conviction. So, for example, an atheist who thinks that it's likely that there isn't a God, but acknowledges that there isn't a knockdown proof, you know, there isn't it isn't provable scientifically that there isn't a God, that would be an agnostic atheist. And then the last term that you mentioned was humanists, and while the other terms focus on what we don't believe and how strong our convictions are, the term humanist tells you what people do believe. Humanists are people who believe science is the best way to understand the natural world, and that ethics ought to be based on human needs and human compassion rather than on theological ideas. And the way, I think the easiest way to tell the difference between a humanist and a religious person, specifically Christians, Jews, and Muslims, would be to look at the question of the meaning of life and how we approach that. Mm. From the broadly religious perspective, at least the Christian perspective I was brought up in, there is one meaning of life, which is to glorify God in all that you do, which is a wonderful thing. But humanists approach the question from a different angle. We don't think that there's just one meaning of life. We think that every human being chooses their own meaning in life based on what their talents, their skills, and their particular contributions of society they want to be. And so in this difference, the way that humans each choose their own meaning, each choose their own purpose in life, I think that's probably the strongest way to characterize the difference. Humanists are people who choose the meaning for their lives.
Thank you so much. Rita, for folks here, Hinduism might be the one that people have the hardest time kind of identifying. So how would you tell if somebody was Hindu?
First of all, most Hindus don't know what it is to be a Hindu. That's one way you can identify a Hindu. A clueless person walking around saying, come to my festival, it's all about a way of life, and the food's great. That's a Hindu. But what should a Hindu be? As a Hindu theologian, I would tell them that when you present yourself to other people, please don't do that. It's embarrassing. And we have a 5,000-year-old written history and a longer oral history, so please study it. And they would say, no, we'll stick to the food. So that's basically a Hindu, but what would I like to have be a Hindu? What would my dream be? I have a dream, and that is that Hindus would actually read their scriptures and would understand that the foundation of the Hindu vision, of Hindu Dharma's vision, is that the divine manifests through all things and all beings, and therefore we are not to love our neighbor as ourself, but to see our neighbor as ourself. To not see others as others, but to see everyone as yourself. To not do charity unto others, but to do good because you're doing it for yourself. That there be no distinction between oneself and one's environment, that everything we do as service. Not a service to a God, but to service to the one God without whom there is nothing.
And Rita, for education for us, the Hindu scriptures are called?
The Hindu scriptures are called the Veda. Like you have the Torah, the Bible, the Hindu scriptures are called the Veda. And like the Bible, like the Torah, there are many, many books inside that. But the foundation of it is an equation. And the equation is what is the self equals ultimate reality. In other words, there is only one self, only one subjectivity, only one reality, and we are embedded in it as waves of an ocean are part of the ocean. We are part of the divine.
Thank you. And Rich, how about for Christianity? How do you know if somebody's a Christian?
I think there are two prominent answers that we would find if we were to take a survey in the Christian community. Some people say, if you want to know whether someone's a Christian, you ask them whether they believe the right kinds of things about Jesus, and about the Trinity, about the authority of the Bible. And others would say, well, you can believe all those things and be a pretty bad person. And a lot depends on how you live, your way of life. And I think once we recognize the difference between those two, we can put them together and say that if you want to know someone as a Christian, we want them to be able to understand and articulate who Jesus is and what he has done for us, but also the kinds of people that he calls us to be, the life of discipleship, as we call it, where we serve him. It's a way of life that's grounded in an understanding of who the Savior is and how that fits into the larger biblical message.
As we think about, you know, we live in a world and a society that is very, very pluralistic, and a lot of times we just don't have conversations about faith, about spirituality outside of the church with folks that are like us, and that's part of why we're so grateful that you all would be here this weekend. Stereotyping is really easy, just to say, well, I know this about your label, and therefore I think I know you. So the question here, and this, anybody who wants to can answer this one, everybody doesn't have to, but where does the media, where do you think folks in your tradition would say, the media often gets this wrong about us, and I wish it didn't?
Well, we don't have a media issue. We don't have a PR problem at all. You know, it's the nature of media is that what bleeds leads, and you know, it's a very sensationalistic. I was reflecting earlier on this 9/11 memorial service that we would hold at the Islamic Center of Southern California, where I used to serve as the religious director and imam. And we had been putting it on for many years, and maybe about 5 or 6 years after 9/11, we had the media show up. We would always invite them. They would never come because it was boring. We would have a full house like this with, and we would give awards to a rabbi, a pastor, a civic leader who had worked tirelessly to bring communities together and bridge the gaps of understanding. But one occasion, the media showed up and they said, you know, what are you doing here? And I explained all of that. And they said, and then I figured out why they were there. They said, later on this afternoon, there's going to be a group protesting and burning down the image of Osama bin Laden. This was before he was killed. And what do you think about that? And I said, well, you know, that's not our MO. We don't go out and shout and protest. We try and listen, compassionately understand one another and work together for the common good. And the media, this was on camera, right? So she, you know, paused the camera, she pulled me aside, she goes, oh, come on, you could say something more sexy than that. So she wanted me to yell and scream and to, you know, fit the image that she was looking for. And so I think the nature of media is that it doesn't give the opportunity for deep understanding. This is the medium right here that you're putting on here at this church, where we can really engage in a more profound understanding of one another, listen to each other's hearts, and identify what it is that we have in common. But you know, so we have challenges in three regards. I would say the first is that, you know, just the very basic idea of where Islam is, and I spoke to that earlier when I said, you know, what it is that we fundamentally believe: one God. And trying to become better human beings so that we can stand before him on that day, hoping for his grace and mercy. The second misconception is that Islam equals terrorism, or Islam equals violence. And this is a theme that's, to be honest, is manifested in the media, but is perpetrated by people who are claiming to be Muslim in parts of the world. I would suggest that the reason why they're doing that isn't rooted in the religion. It's because of geopolitics, and there's some slippery black stuff that's liquidy that people are fighting over in that part of the world. And oil and economics and other things are at the cause of it, nationalism and ethnicity and geopolitics. But and religion is invoked, but it's really not what's behind it. However, I think religion can be the solution, and not just the Muslim community condemning that and speaking out against that barbarism, but I think coming together across not only nations, but of faith communities to speak together for the humanity and to provide opportunity and hope for people in those war-torn areas and give them a better alternative than resorting to violent extremist methods. So the third thing that I think we're challenged with in the media is that Islam mistreats women. And it's very true that many Muslim cultures and individuals around the world mistreat women, prevent them from education, don't allow them to drive in certain countries, all kinds of mistreatment of women, honor killings, etc. Muslims mistreat women, but Islam does not mistreat women, and those who are carrying that out are doing so in contradiction to the teachings and the message of Islam, which is a religion that might be surprising to most, actually empowers women. Empowers women to be educated, to play an important role in leading society, and an integral spiritual component to a healthy world, and especially in families. And so, those are the three things. And lastly, I'll just say that Islam overall is looked at as a threat, and there was a Pew study that says that by 2050, Muslims are going to be the largest religion in the planet, and that might be scary to some people, but I think that given that trajectory, it behooves us to try and reclaim the heritage and the true teachings of Islam that promotes a pluralism, civic engagement. And there's a verse in the Quran that says, it's a commandment, that it's God's will that there be diversity. And so strive as if in a race in doing what is virtuous with one another. To the end, in the end you'll all be returned to God and he'll tell you about the differences. But our commandment in that verse is that we appreciate the diversity of God's creation and that we try and identify the common values that we share and cooperate for the common good together. And I think that this conversation is a good starting point towards that end. So thank you for the invitation.
Thank you for that. Anybody else around that one? How does media sometimes get stuff wrong that you wish they didn't? Yeah.
Yeah, I think I'd jump in here much along the same lines as jihad. Unfortunately, when you hear about atheists in the media, you usually hear about Richard Dawkins or Sam Harris or the late Christopher Hitchens. And I'm here to tell you folks, that's not the whole picture. For over the years, atheists have been kind of painted as angry and bitter and upset, and that's just not the case. These days, the students at Stanford, who I work with, and people that I knew from Harvard, are much more interested in social justice issues and are interested in forming partnerships with religious people of good faith who want to solve some of these issues. So when I look out at the religious landscape today and I see humanists trying to work with Jews and Muslims and Christians and Buddhists, that makes me really happy. And days like today where we all get together and talk about our different traditions, I think are quite useful in showing that while there are definitely significant differences, and that should be clear by now, we have so much in common. And so many of the problems that affect our world don't rely on having one particular faith perspective. We can all agree that children shouldn't be hungry at the end of the night and things like that. And so I just see a way forward through interfaith dialogue and by partnering with religious groups.
Thanks.
I think the media gets religion wrong in general.
Yeah.
I really do. I mean, I was sitting here thinking, I think Christianity is misportrayed in the media. You were saying earlier that Hindus are portrayed as New Age gurus, and it's not a reflection of the diversity of the Hindu experience. I think religion is misportrayed, and I imagine the struggles that each one of us in this hall, in this church, has gone through, and all the celebrations and all the struggles, and what prayer really looks like, and what a pastor really does and who a pastor really is, or a rabbi or an imam. The media shows religion as rule-bound fundamentalists, mm-hmm. because, as you said, right, what bleeds leads and the other is not sexy. But there are too few opportunities, I think, for us to see religion and religiousness doing what it really does in each of our lives. It's all too rare.
Thanks. I want to try to do something different. None of the other services got this one, and the next one may not, but I want to just give it a shot. Rich, if you're open to trying it. One of the aspects of Christianity, or at least the Christianity that our church and Rich at Fuller Seminary would share, is that there would be a desire for other people to come to know God and to come to know Jesus. And so there would be a universal, invitational aspect of that. Trying to do that in a way that's universal on the one hand, but doesn't just become a, I want you on my team or I want to win you over to my side person, there's a tension in that. So would you talk a little bit about, as you look at folks on this panel, what would your hopes for them be relative to Jesus? And then if you guys could respond as Rich does that, did he do it well? Did he not do it well? I had to have him grade me when I was going through school, so now we can turn the tables.
So we are keeping score.
Yeah, this part we're keeping score. It's just for Rich. But it's a real... the reason I ask it, it's a very important and very sensitive question because it's a part of what we feel as people who follow Jesus is that we'd like to talk about that and invite people into it. But so often it's been done in a way that can be imperialistic or dehumanizing or have superiority with it. And there's a tension there. And Rich, you're as good at this as anybody I know. So stop looking so confused and help us.
Couldn't you come up with something sexier than that, John?
Not when I look at you. Sorry. Oh, I'm sorry. I'll go now.
No, I
did say almost everyone here was hospitable and kind and generous.
I think this particular group is I think it's an interesting case in point because my good friend Sean has studied alongside of Christians. I think what we're seeing in evangelical Jewish relations is an understanding that we haven't had so much of before, that on our side, we really appreciate the Jewishness of Jesus. And we see ourselves as grafted on. That's what Paul says in Romans. We've become a part of Israel, not denying the Israel that's already there. I mean, as a spiritual, theological people. And on the Jewish side, more and more, many Jews, you think of Amy Levine and others who are taking an interest in Jesus from a Jewish perspective. And so we have so much to talk about. The old complete polarization is not there. We still disagree.
Right.
Now with jihad, I mean, the wonderful things that you've just said, that you're a follower of Jesus Christ. And you and I would have a lot to talk about in terms of the cross, because that's really the stumbling block between us in that. But at the same time, I'm not willing to say, well, unless you agree with me on the cross, we don't really have much to talk about. I think we're well on the way into a good conversation. And if we could just do more of, what is it about you as a Muslim that so fascinates you about Jesus and that you want to follow him, you want to learn from him? And to me, that's a wonderful place to start. And so I'm not going to come into this with all or nothing or anything like that.
It really begins with getting to know each person and what do we have to talk about from that point.
And just what John has been saying to us, that he doesn't want to come across as an angry atheist who would like to put us out of business, but rather, are there things we can do together? And that you're willing to say, if we can get together and feed hungry children, and deal with sexual trafficking and show a more robust care for the creation. I want to enter into that with you as someone who feels that the Lord of all creation is asking me to do those things. And you're not going to turn me away because of that. And my good friend Rita, I mean, you know, I never again will I talk about idolatry and Hinduism. I mean, that sense that you're bowing down before these false idols, because as you've argued so eloquently, these are not gods that you're worshiping, but there's something behind all of that, and something, and I believe, the Apostle Paul said, it is in him that we live and move and have our being, and you and I would have a lot of disagreements and arguments about that, but we have so much to talk about. And it's such a wonderful conversation in a time when we're not coming from these silos where none of us really understand each other, but we're in a pluralistic society in which all of these ideas are out there, and it's important for us to keep talking. And somebody came up after the last service and just said, Listening to that Muslim, never again will I see a Muslim at Trader Joe's and think that person must want to kill me. And I got to say, that is a wonderful place to start.
Mm-hmm.
Because the stereotype and the vicious imagery of what a Muslim is, our neighbors. And, you know, my grandchildren go to school. One of my grandsons, his best friend, is named Muhammad. He doesn't like it when he hears, even from the pulpit, things said about Muslims that just don't fit his friendship with Muhammad, or his friendship with a Druze, who is a Hindu whose family came from India. These are very important things right now, and I just want to say I care deeply about talking about Jesus and who he is, but I feel like there's a new openness for places to start in all of these conversations.
So how did Rich do? Yeah, Sean.
I think we disagree on less than one might think, which is to say that the issue is certainty. Something that people frequently don't know about the history of Judaism historically is that a number of people claiming to be Messiah have emerged. It kind of happens every few hundred years, and then it doesn't work out so well. People have been crucified. People have been executed. Mm. People have been have ended up converting to Islam, as with the Shabtai Tzvi. The Lubavitcher Rebbe died with people claiming that he was the Messiah. And I think Judaism would the best answer that a deeply humble and honest Jewish answer would be is, we just don't know. I mean, the joke is that the Messiah is going to come. There's going to be a press conference in Jerusalem, inevitably, right? And there are going to be a gaggle of reporters, and the first question is going to be, everybody's dying to know, have you been here before? And the Messiah, and she will say, no comment. I mean, fundamentally, the Jewish claim would be that the Messiah is supposed to do some things that haven't happened yet. And at the end of the end of the end of the day, I believe that the Messiah will come. And I don't know who's going to be standing at the gate of heaven. I don't know. That's my best answer.
Yeah.
If you believe that that is Jesus, I would hope that our common conversation would would say that all people of faith, that it's ultimately God who's deciding who's getting through the gate. Okay. Our certainty, our human certainty, our finite certainty, our arrogant certainty is what divides us.
Yeah, I hope we get to the gate at the same time, because I'd like to make your case for you.
Okay, thanks. Listen, I heard a group of religious leaders of another Christian tradition say, you know, we're all on the airplane going to heaven, but that group thinks they're in first class. As far as I'm concerned, I'll fly coach. I don't mind.
I hate to do this. We got to stop. We got one more service to go. We're enormously grateful. Part of what we're all aware of is throughout history, often people who wear the name of Christian have had much to repent for. Yep. In lack of love and even persecution for every one of the traditions that's up here on this platform. And we want to get better. We want to love better. And you have helped us do that. And you have put names and bodies and faces and voices behind what can too often be labels for us. And we're enormously grateful to you. So can you all let them know our gratitude for being able to be here? So we thought this would be kind of a cool to actually tag team the blessing. We normally do a blessing of folks at the end of a service, And Rich is going to do it in English, and Sean is going to join him and do it in the original language. So.
The blessing that the brother of Moses, Aaron the priest, gave to his people. May the Lord bless you and keep you.
Yivarechecha Adonai v'yishmerecha.
May the Lord make his face to shine upon you and be gracious to you.
Ya'er Adonai panav elecha v'yikunecha.
May the Lord lift up the light of his countenance upon each of you and give you peace.
Yisa Adonai panav elecha v'yasem lecha shalom.
And all God's people say,
Amen.
Amen. Amen.